If you remember, 1 Chronicles 1 through 9 was a lot of genealogical material. Again, sometimes it becomes a little bit challenging to go through that. 1 Chronicles 10 is all about the death of Saul. A lot of this material is repeat material, but it's there for a reason. It's there for a purpose. At the time that this material was written, the Israelites are coming back out of bondage, out of slavery, out of being captured by a foreign oppressor, taken off to a foreign land. They have now been given permission to re-enter the land and re-establish their worship. The chronicler, who most people believe is Ezra, is trying to write a history for the people to remind them of who they are. Sometimes we get lost and confused with all the stuff going around us that we fail to maintain an identity of being in a relationship with God. For us, it's our relationship with Christ as we look back on the cross. For Old Testament, it's their relationship with God as they look forward to the Messiah. So these people needed encouragement. They needed strength. They've come out of a long, dry season. These are people who would say things like, God feels far away from me right now. Or, I don't know if God really loves me anymore. And I think all of us have gone through those times. They're going through it collectively as a nation. So this is why the chronicler is making sure they understand that God, in fact, does have a plan. He is not surprised by anything. And the chronicler is going to take you through a history to help you reestablish that, yes, God is in control. I can trust him with my life. Even when things around me are not going the way I want, or things around me are so chaotic and crazy, I don't really know what to do. The early church, as they're reestablishing, had problems with worship. They would come into an area, and as they're rebuilding the temple, some people were screaming and yelling, praise God, this is awesome. And then there was another group that was screaming and yelling, oh my gosh, what have we done? And they're lamenting how there was the good old days. And it's interesting that in this worshiping community back then, they had two different distinct viewpoints, and yet they all came together under one umbrella. This is perfectly mirroring what's happening now in today's culture. We are seeing a nation divided. Some are ecstatic beyond belief and saying, praise God of what's happened. And others are lamenting and crying, what have we done? This takes our eyes off of what is happening around us and putting our eyes onto Christ and what he has done for us, for them to refocus their viewpoint on what is important. So 1 Chronicles chapter 11, we'll read quickly verses 1 through 3. As we look forward to this, notice the unity. That is what the chronicler is trying to get across. That you may have different, distinct viewpoints, but there can be, in fact, a uniting force behind it. And this is what they needed as they re-entered the land. They're reminded of what King David did. All Israel came together to David at Hebron and said, we are your own flesh and blood. In the past, even when Saul was king, you were the one who led Israel on their military campaigns. And the Lord your God said to you, you will be shepherd. You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler. When all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, he made a compact with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel as the Lord had promised through Samuel. You're going to see it in the chapters ahead. Different factions, different group, different family relationships, different viewpoints of who should be king. Saul's out, David's in. Yet they all said, let's come together as the people of God in order to celebrate what he is doing for us. And that's what they did. They anointed David as the king. Though it had taken a long time for it to happen, it finally happened. And one of the things that David does first and foremost is establishing a headquarters, a base of operations, which continues even to this day for the Jewish people. If you ask a Jewish person, what is your base of operations? Where is the center of Judaism? They would all answer, Jerusalem. That is our place. And it all started, if you ever wondered where did it come from, it came from this, where David conquers Jerusalem. I'd love to get into all this cool stuff with what actually takes place, but Let's read the story, and you'll see how David conquers Jerusalem. David and all the Israelites marched to Jerusalem, that is Jebus, that was its name beforehand. The Jebusites who lived there said to David, "You will not get in here." Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David. David had said, "Whoever leads the attack on the Jebusites will become commander-in-chief." This is such a cool story. You just got to Google it and read what happens. The Jerusalem was very well fortified, and David throws this thing out. "Hey, if you can conquer the place, you're going to be my commander-in-chief. You're going to lead the armies." And they found a cistern, an underground water tunnel that led right to the heart of the city, but no one had known about it except for the people inside. So a guy named Joab, he actually figures it out. Joab happens to be related, I believe, as a nephew of David, and he figures this out, and he leads this charge inside the city and captures the city with relative ease. Not much of a battle takes place. And it's an incredible story. You really should read about it. here it's designed to, again, invoke some sort of pride as a worshiping community that God is our leader. So Joab, son of Zeruiah, went up first, and so he received the command. David then took up residence in the fortress, and so is called the city of David. He built up the city around it from the supporting terraces to the surrounding wall while Joab restored the rest of the city, and David became more and more powerful because the Lord was with them. What we read next is some stories about the people who are around David. And these were some really important people. I mean, you see the heading there that they're David's mighty men. And you ask the question, why are these stories included? It's to invoke in us a willingness to sacrifice for the benefit of other people. They are stories of such heroism that at first blush you wonder, why are they here? But they're there, so they're inspirational. Do you ever hear stories of people making a sacrifice, and after you hear the story, it makes you want to do the same thing? September 11th, 2001, 39 people huddled in the back of Flight 93, wondering what they were going to do because their plane had just been hijacked. One of the stewardesses is already dead. She's been knifed. And as her body lays in the middle of the walkway, the 39 wonder, what are we going to do? They'd been told by the hijackers that there was a bomb on board, and that they were all about to die unless they stayed under control. Those 39 people all started making phone calls to all of their family, all of their friends. They quickly found out that they were just one plane in a string of many planes who had been hijacked. And as they talked to their loved ones, they realized two planes had already crashed into the two towers, and one had already hit the Pentagon. And now they realized, there's not a bomb on board. We are the bomb. And we are about to be used for some purpose that they don't know. And they quickly surmised that if they do nothing, thousands of people are going to die. So they start making phone calls again. One lady makes a phone call to her husband, who sadly was unable to get to the phone but left a message about what was about to happen, and that she was sad that her and her unborn child would never see them again. One of the stewardesses makes a phone call to her mother, and then she quickly says, "I have to get off the phone. I'm in charge of boiling the hot water that we're going to use." Other people making their final calls to their loved ones, saying, "We're going to take the plane, and if need be, we're going to put it into the ground." A vote is taken, and it's unanimous. It doesn't matter if anyone dies right now, we're going to take this plane back because we're not going to let it hit whatever intended target it was supposed to hit. So they rush the cabin. They try to breach it. The recorder doesn't quite tell us exactly what happened, but they had either just breached it or were about to breach it. The terrorists did everything they could. They had tossed the plane left and right, up and down. Bodies were flying all over the cabin, but they still had one resolute concept. We must take this plane. And they finally get into it, and the voices are heard on the recorder of the pilot who had taken over the plane, and the decision was made, we put it in the ground. So as they were breaching, and there's also some people believe that they had actually grabbed the stick, the people in the plane finally had recaptured it, they grabbed the stick, push it straight down, and as it goes down, it hits with such force that a fireball explosion larger than the trees around it erupted. When they found the black box recorder, it was 25 feet underground. I hear stories like that, and I'm always amazed. They were willing to sacrifice themselves so that other people would live. They didn't look at their lives as something that was so holy that it was not expendable for the benefit of other people. And as this group of people heading back into the land, we learned something really important, that life is about sacrifice. That our lives, anyone who calls God, God, and Jesus Christ, Lord, is to live a life of sacrifice. Willing to not look just to your own benefit, but for the benefit of the people around you. I hear stories like this all the time. Incredible stories. Stories like Flight 93. I hear stories of a person who was advancing through the ranks of their law firm, and it finally came out that she was on the fast track to partner, but she found out she was pregnant, and God had blessed her with a child, and she made a decision to sacrifice her career for the benefit of her child and her family. Incredible sacrifice. I hear of a pastor friend of mine who needed a kidney. And when they went around searching, they found a perfect match, and that was in this man's son. And the son said, I would be happy. I would be joy-filled to sacrifice my kidney for you. And when I talked to the pastor, he says, it was a hard decision for me as a father to accept this sacrifice from the son. But he says, when you talk to the son, he says, that's not that big of a deal at all. I'm willing to sacrifice for someone else. We think of course, the person who gave the greatest sacrifice, and that was Christ, who was not willing to just stay up in heaven, but was willing to leave his heavenly abode, come down here amongst us, came down to live among us, walk among us, and he didn't just teach, he didn't just heal, he didn't just lead, but he ultimately gave his life in sacrifice for the benefit of others, you and me. A huge sacrifice that ended in our salvation. We're going to read stories that are just like this. We're going to read stories of people making tremendous sacrifices for others. So let's take a look at this. We're going to first read all about a guy by the name of Jashobeam. And as we read that story, you tell me what his sacrifice, what he was willing to do. Starting in verse 10, these were the chiefs of David, mighty men. They, along with all Israel, gave his kingship strong support to extend it over the whole land as the Lord had promised. So they're doing this for a purpose. The purpose, community is strongest when people sacrifice. Churches are strongest when people sacrifice. Marriages are strongest when people sacrifice. Friendships are strongest when people sacrifice. That's why they're doing this. Verse 11, this is the list of David's mighty men. We first hear about Jashobeam. He was a Hachmonite. He was chief of the officers. He raised his spear against 300 men whom he killed in one encounter. Can you imagine that? Oh my, yeah. One encounter. So this wasn't like, oh, he killed 300 over his lifetime. This was a guy who took his stand with a spear. He was willing to sacrifice himself and fight the enemy and do whatever it took in order to save people. 300 guys in one shot. This is part of David's mighty men. Now, David had a whole crew. He had a group that they were called the 30, and then he had a group called the 3. Now, the 30, it's really fun. We're going to see the listing later on. This 30, there was actually more than 30. It was more like 47, but that doesn't sound really cool. But the 30, like, yeah, David's got the 30. But then there was the elite squad, the group that was really powerful, the special forces group, the top of that 30, and they were called the 3. And Jashobeam is one of the 3, and you can see why he was one of the 3. He was willing to fight, to do whatever it takes, sacrifice for other people. Now we're going to get another one. He was also one of the 3, and you're going to listen to his exploits. You got to imagine when people are willing to sacrifice, but also when people are willing to sacrifice when everyone else runs. Have you ever seen that? You go to take your stand, and sometimes we receive a lot of strength from the people around us, and when everyone else is sacrificing, it's a little bit easier to sacrifice. But what happens if everyone pulls out? What if everyone backs away? Listen to this story. Next to him was Eleazar, son of Dodai, the Ahuite, one of the 3 mighty men. He was with David at Pas Damim when the Philistines gathered there for a battle at a place where there was a field full of barley. The troops fled from the Philistines, but they took their stand in the middle of the field. They defended it and struck the Philistines down, and the Lord brought about a great victory. Like, can you imagine that? They've come into the field like, we're going to defend this field. This is what we're going to stand right here. And all of David's men are with them. And David and Eleazar are there, and we're leading this. And all of a sudden, the Philistines show up, and the rest of the troops go, I think I'm out. I'm gone. This looks like too much of a battle. This looks like too much of a sacrifice. I don't think I can stay with you. And they all start running. Everyone runs except for 2 people. Eleazar and David. And they said, you know what? Even if everyone else doesn't think this sacrifice is worth it, I'm going to do it. Have you ever had to sometimes stand alone in a field? Everyone else is running, and you're like, I'm going to take my stand, and I'm going to do it because this is the right thing to do. This is David and Eleazar. And it's great because some people say, well, what's the big deal? Well, that field full of barley, this was a source of food. I don't know about you, but if I was the owner of the barley field, I think I'd be pretty thankful that they took their stand right there and defended the field. They know that community is strongest when the people are willing to sacrifice for the benefit of others. The next story is probably one of my favorite stories in this whole section because it answers the question, what happens if the amount that I am willing to sacrifice is not commensurate with the result? Do you ever ask that? I would love to sacrifice for my husband, but I'm not going to get anything out of it. I'm going to sacrifice and sacrifice and sacrifice and give, 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 and he's not going to do anything. I don't even know if anything will come out of it. And so you ask yourself the question, is it worth it? Sometimes people think this, helping the homeless. You know, it's Saturday and Searchlight's about to go do its homeless ministry, and you're like, man, I have got a lot of things to do. And to be honest, really, what's at the end of the day, what is just handing out some food and someone else can actually do that? And it's really not that big of a deal. And you say to yourself, the sacrifice I have to give is much larger than the benefit I'm going to get out of it. Do you ever think like that? I think people think this way, way all the time. Guys, what happens when it comes time to watch a movie with your wife? And she wants to watch Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. And you're thinking to yourself, I would rather watch Star Wars Rogue One. Yeah. And you think to yourself, what's the big deal? If I sacrifice and have to watch a stupid chick flick, what do I really get out of it? The benefit is not really that great. I end up watching that. I see single moms do this all the time when their kids are in baseball and cheerleading, and they have to run their kids, from practice to practice and practice. They got to sacrifice their Tuesday nights, their Thursday nights, their Saturday all day. And you just sacrifice for those bratty little kids. And they're not thankful. They're not grateful. They don't realize that you just gave up a whole day of doing something that maybe could benefit you. But instead, have you ever thought about the sacrifices your parents make for you? And what do they get out of it? It's seemingly insignificant. It's like, there's really not much benefit. But for some reason, parents sacrifice. Do you do that with your friends? You're about to go out with a group of your friends, and then you find out that one of them is at home because they're depressed over a breakup with their boyfriend or girlfriend. And you ask yourself a question, should I go over and hang out with them? But they're so depressed, and it's going to make me sad. And the rest of the group is going out and having fun. Would you be willing to sacrifice and sit with someone who just needs a friend? We get these questions all the time. And we're asked to sacrifice all over the place. And we always do like a spreadsheet. Well, what's the benefit I'm going to get from it? If the benefit is not that great, then I don't think I'm going to make the sacrifice. And this story is going to tell us otherwise. This story is going to say that sometimes the ending result may not seem so important, but we got to remember that it's not about us anyway. What is the other person going to get from it? It involves David and his longing for a cup of water. Verse 15, 3 of the 30 chiefs came down to David to the rock at the cave of Adullam, while a band of Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim. At that time, David was in the stronghold, and the Philistine garrison was at Bethlehem. David longed for water and said, that someone would get me a drink of water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem. Now, we don't know. That some people have theorized that there was really not that much water in the area. A parallel passage talks about how this was during harvest time, so it would have been the dry season, so maybe there wasn't much water. I think most people agree, though, that this is mostly nostalgia. David is remembering back to his childhood, and there was that well right near the gate, and when you would drink that water, you knew you were drinking Bethlehem water, and it was something that was incredible for him. And he's just like, I would love to just have a sip of it. The three, remember, you got the 30, you got the three. The three overhear this. And they say, maybe we should go get this cup of water. Now, I would have loved to have heard that conversation, because someone would have had to have said at some point, dude, it's a cup of water. Who really cares? Do you understand what it would take for them at the cave of Adullam? They would have to hike 6 miles. They would have to break through the Philistine encampment around Bethlehem. They'd have to break in, and then they'd have to scoop some water up. Then they would have to break out, fighting twice while walking essentially 12 miles, all so that David could have a cup of water. Now, would you do that? Hey, David, I got a cup of water for you here. Where'd you get it from? Bethlehem. Yeah. Because that doesn't involve much sacrifice. I mean, it's a whole lot easier to do that. But these guys, they loved David. They were loyal to David, and they knew that the army is strongest when people are willing to sacrifice. So what do? Verse 18, so the three broke through the Philistine lines, drew water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem, and carried it back to David. Isn't that crazy? They did it. They actually succeeded. They went, got the water, fought through the Philistine line twice, brought it to him. Now, what do you think David's reaction should be? A simple thank you would be, I mean, that would be kind of a nice thing, like, thanks. Wow, you know, that's really, you know, we're all taught that. You know, you get that Christmas present that really wasn't that good, but you have to pretend, you have to do a little acting. You're like, oh, thank you so much. I really wanted another Christmas tie. That's beautiful. David is going to do something that when we read it, I promise you, you will be offended, but it's only because we don't understand what David is doing. I'm in the middle of verse 18. But he refused to drink it. Instead, he poured it out before the Lord. Thank you so much. And then he goes over to the little makeshift altar where they've been worshiping, and he takes the water, and he just pours it out. And if you were one of David's mighty men, what might you do at that point? Do you want to know what we had to sacrifice to get there? Like, can you imagine that? But again, this is, we're missing because David is about to give a speech where he, essentially what he's going to say is, this was such an incredible gift. This gift of sacrifice that these people gave was so high that there is only one person who is worthy of receiving it. And that is God himself. So if you are one of David's mighty men, this, you're not insulted by this. It's something that's even more precious. And that's what he essentially says, verse 19. God forbid it that I should do this. He said, should I drink the blood of these men who went at the risk of their lives? He was essentially saying, this water is like your guys' blood. You fought, and there's no way I could ever drink this. I'm not worthy enough to do this. And so David sacrifices for the benefit of his three. That's amazing. And it then just finishes up, because they risked their lives to bring it back, David would not drink it. Such were the exploits of the three mighty men. This is the hard one. I'm telling you, I think there's, you read the story and it almost like doesn't fit into the rest of the narrative. You're like, there was a cup of water and he was thirsty, and so they went and they got it and he brought the water back. But this is telling us an incredible, important lesson, that there will be times you will sacrifice, and that sacrifice is much greater than what you're going to get out of it. And God would say, sacrifice anyway. Oh, do you have a question? Yes. Yeah, this is one of the difficulties with this particular thing. It's a recap of the three that are mentioned in 2 Samuel. There's debates on exactly which one it is. In my studies, I believe that the third is a guy named Shema, and Shema was actually with David and Eliezer at the field. And the only reason why I know that is because I wrote about it in my book. If you haven't picked that up lately, it's a great story, defending the lentil field. So you would have to go back and re-look at 2 Samuel to get the third mighty guy in there. My professor in class asked that exact same question about, like, I thought you said there was three. And I'm like, well, this is what the text says. So this is all we got. So these were the three. Now, there's others that are really, really impressive. Get it in your head that sometimes we sacrifice and it's going to be a big result. You know, I think of people that sacrifice for their children. You know that there's a big payout there, right? You know that eventually your kids will grow up and actually be normal, productive people in society and not, well, you hope so. I mean, that's why we sacrifice. That's why we do it. That's why we take them to 5:30 a.m. practices and why we go on Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturdays, or why we go to band concerts and Yeah, let them pick up an instrument. You know, I remember so vividly when my parents came to one of my first band concerts, and I know this is your life now. And, you know, I look back on it and I go, that was terrible. And you know what they said? That was music to my ears. That was beautiful. They came and listened to so many nasty band concerts. And they smiled and they clapped, and it was a sacrifice. Why? Because they knew that there was something that was good. And even if you can't see the benefit, much like David in the cup, or you serving a homeless person, or you being there with a friend who needs you, you may never know what that's actually going to do for them. Yeah. Correct. It's what you would do. Right. And this is when you think of people like firefighters that everyone else is rushing out and they're rushing in and they're like, you're a hero. And they go, no, it's just what I do. It's just who I am. When we sacrifice out of a motivation of love, it makes the sacrifice almost unsacrificial, but it still is a sacrifice. But when we're motivated by, I need to give this to you so that you will give something to me in return, now the sacrifice is much harder to make. And if I am not reciprocated, then I may not sacrifice for you in the future. All right, this next guy, I love what happens with him. Abishai, take a look at what he did. It's pretty incredible. Abishai, the brother of Joab, of verse 20, was chief of the three. He raised a spear against 300 men whom he killed, and so he became as famous as the three. He was doubly honored above the three and became their commander, even though he was not included among them. Yeah, now this Abishai and this spear... pretty incredible what he was able to do. And then they keep going. Other stories of sacrifice. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was a valiant fighter from Kabzeel who performed great exploits. He struck down two of Moab's best men. So often what they would do back in those days is we're going to put our best, instead of having our armies fight and, you know, lots of death, why don't we do this? You send out your best guy, we send out our best guy, they duke it out. Whoever wins, wins. The army essentially wins. This is that whole David and Goliath story. That's the reason why Goliath went out there day after day. Like, he's the champion. He's you know, the leader of the mixed martial arts. He's the top of UFC heavyweight fights. This guy could battle anybody. And that's what this is. Benaiah, even though he's just part of the 30, he's not even like the top of the top. He goes out and he takes out two of Moab's best men. This is interesting, too. He went down into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. Yeah, what? Who cares, right? Who cares about a lion in a pit, snow? This is an important story because of what is actually happening. That pit was probably their water source. It was a cistern. It was a well. And it was snowing, and that's the good thing, because when snow gets in the well, it melts, and eventually it's good. Well, what happens if a lion gets down there? Yeah, and then when the snow melts, and you go to pull up a water bucket, and essence of lion. Yeah, that's not that good. So really what this guy's doing, he's sacrificed. Now, how many of you would be willing to... Now, this cistern, it's not going to be very wide, right? Like, it's... Now, would you be willing to jump? There is a lion down there, and he's pissed because he's trapped. Have you ever fought a trapped animal? I've battled trapped teenagers sometimes. They're vicious, man. Look out. I've battled trapped men, and they're fighters. I've trapped cats, trapped mamas, mama fighting for, oh, my goodness, you don't want to. So this dude jumps down into the well. Not much room to maneuver. Now, granted, I think I would probably go down with spear pointing down first. Like, maybe if I hit his head first, that'll be perfect. But he's doing this for the purpose of saving the town. He could die. I mean, this is not looking good. But he does it. He's willing to sacrifice himself for the benefit of others. I love some of this other stuff. And he struck down an Egyptian who was 7.5 feet tall. He was like Joshua size. It was crazy. Taller than Joshua, which is really impossible. Although the Egyptian had a spear like a weaver's rod in his hand, Benaiah went against him with a club. He snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. This is like ninja, man. Like David's mighty ninjas. American ninja warrior here. He just goes up and he's like, what? Grab the spear, stab, boom. And it's pretty incredible. One of them, the parallel passage was really interesting. He killed a bunch with a sword. And he says that he fought so hard that his hand froze. Have you ever fought so hard and so long that you cramp up? Do you ever do that in life? You fight so hard and so long that it actually now hurts you. There's others that say that it not only froze because his muscles had cramped and tightened around it, but because of the blood that had poured over it and hardened that he couldn't get it off the sword. These are people that have determination. And that's the tough thing about sacrifice too, isn't it? Sometimes I could sacrifice one time, and that's not that hard. But sacrifice twice, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 20, 100 times for the same person? That's to have that type of determination that says, I'm not going to give up. To have the type of determination to not abandon David in the field. The type of determination that would go out and get a cup of water for your leader. Incredible. I love it. These were the exploits of Benaiah, son of Jehoiada. He was famous as the three mighty men, 25. He was held in greater honor than any of the 30, but he was not included among the three, and David put him in charge of his bodyguard. I love it. First Secret Service agent right there. Then you see the list there, and if you go through the list, if I remember, I believe there's 37 in this list, but they're the 30, because that sounds more vicious than the 37. I want to note a couple of things. First of all, look at verse 41. Uriah the Hittite. Anyone know who that is? Yeah. We often remember the David-Bathsheba story. And David's like, ooh, Bathsheba looking kind of nice there. And goes, sleeps with her. She gets pregnant. He's like, let's come up with this great idea. Let's bring back her husband, whose name was Uriah the Hittite, bring him in, they'll sleep together, and then no one will know, like it'll be right around the same time, we'll cover up the pregnancy. And Uriah, that noble man, he sacrificed. He says, why would I enjoy the pleasures of my wife when all of my countrymen are out there in the field fighting? And so he slept at the city gate saying, please let me go back because I want to fight and sacrifice, putting almost another shame in David's mark later on. But this is one of those things where, had David met Bathsheba before? I would have to say, yeah, like if Uriah is one of his 30, like you know they're going to have parties and they're all gathered and he's like, oh, hey, Bathsheba, what's up, girl? Looking good there. Uriah's pretty nice there. I think they had met before, which means when David, he's not sleeping with some random stranger. He's sleeping with one of his most trusted officials' wives. As you go through this list, the other thing that sticks out on many of these people is that they're foreigners. Because they knew that God was with David and that David's God was correct. And so and it was amazing that they had the opportunities themselves to arise in the ranks and become part of the 30. But all of these people have this incredible ability to sacrifice. Sacrifice is not a word we like to use, because with sacrifice could come the title of doormat. And we are afraid to sacrifice because we might not get a benefit from it. Someone might take advantage of us. Someone might not be appreciative of it. And we might be then tempted to hold back. But when you look at what God has done, the sacrifice he was willing to make was so huge that many people were going to reject. Some were going to laugh and spit at him. Some were going to stomp on him. Some were going to kick him. Some were going to pierce him. Many were going to laugh at him. And even to this day, thousands and millions reject him. And some might say, that's too bad that he made such a sacrifice and no one really appreciates it. People gather under his name and they go to him and say, God, give me this. God, do this for me. And we often forget, what did he do for us? And we become unappreciative, bratty little children of God. And it's these stories that hopefully bring us back to say, Christ sacrificed everything for me and asked me to then also sacrifice for others. Because that's when community is the strongest. Men, I tell you, if you want a strong marriage, watch that chick flick. Parents, you sacrifice for your kids. And sometimes they don't appreciate it. But we do it anyway because we love them and we care for them. Kids, I know you have to sacrifice for your parents. You have to pretend to like us when you're around your friends and like, oh, there's my mom screaming at the water polo. Hi, Mom! Yeah, sorry, that's her. Yeah. You make sacrifices too. We make sacrifices for our friends. When they are in need of someone to stand with them, we're the ones to do that. We make sacrifices for God, sacrificing ourselves to worship him. May we be people who are willing to sacrifice, because that's when community is the strongest. Let's pray. Lord, forgive us when we have not been people who are willing to sacrifice, when we have been stingy, when we have been more concerned about ourselves as opposed to others. We have done that in our marriages. We have done that to our kids, with our parents, with our friends, with our church. We have often not sacrificed. We've got lots of excuses. We've got lots of reasons. But then we read stuff like 1 Chronicles, and everywhere we turn, whether the outcome was big or small, whether the sacrifice was seemingly important or seemingly insignificant, they did this to come together as a group. And I pray that you would continue to give us, as Searchlight, people willing to sacrifice. That you do that for our marriages. That husbands would sacrifice for their wives. Wives would sacrifice for their husbands. That parents would sacrifice for their kids. That kids would sacrifice for their parents. Friends would sacrifice for each other. Because we know, as a nation, as a state, as a county, as a community, as people, we are strongest when we sacrifice. All because of Jesus Christ, who gave everything for us. It's in his name we pray. Amen.